From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, May 9th, 2017. And on this day, a new complication in an old Portland murder case that's been reopened. And tiny liquor bottles may be added to the bottle bill. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, dedicated to serving injured and disabled Mainers from Kittery to Caribou. JoeBornstein.com. And by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
The judge presiding over the Anthony Sanborn murder case has declined a motion to recuse herself. The Maine Attorney General's office made the request because of concerns over Justice Joyce Wheeler's impartiality. Patty White has more on the developing case that calls into question Sanborn's conviction handed down nearly 30 years ago.
The Attorney General's office request that Justice Joyce Wheeler recuse herself is based on two statements she made during a bail hearing for Sanborn in April, including this one.
This is only a bail hearing, so I cannot apologize to you, Mr. Sanborn, at this time. All I can say is that there is a reasonable likelihood that you will succeed on the petition, and I am going to set bail.
The state took issue with Wheeler's almost apology, claiming it created a perception that she had already decided in favor of Sanborn. In 1992, Sanborn was convicted of murdering Jessica Briggs on a Portland pier. Both were 16 at the time, and a key witness in the case, Hope Cady, who was 13 at the time, claimed to have seen the murder. Sanborn has maintained his innocence, and at the April bail hearing, Hope Cady recanted her original testimony. She said that Portland police detectives coerced her into testifying against Sanborn. Sanborn's defense attorney also argued that the state withheld evidence that Cady had vision problems. Wheeler granted Sanborn bail, but he still awaits a hearing to determine if his murder conviction should be dismissed, reversed, or if he should be granted a new trial. And it appears Justice Wheeler will be the presiding judge in that hearing because she's declined to step down.
Generally speaking, statements made in the context of judicial proceedings are usually not enough to trigger a recusal.
Maine School of Law Associate Professor Dimitri Baum says the Judicial Code of Conduct requires judges to be impartial and maintain the appearance of impartiality. But statements that lead to a judge's recusal are typically made outside of court. That's the argument defense attorney Amy Fairfield used to oppose the request for Wheeler's recusal. In court documents, Fairfield said Wheeler was required to prejudge Sanborn's case in order to determine whether he should be granted bail. Dimitri Baum doesn't take issue with Wheeler's statements during the hearing or her decision not to step down. But he says there is a larger problem with how recusals are handled.
I do think the process itself is somewhat problematic, that you know, a potentially biased judge is really the one who makes a decision on whether or not the judge is biased.
In this case, the Attorney General's office says it accepts Justice Wheeler's response to its recusal request and is prepared to move forward. A hearing to determine the fate of Anthony Sanborn is scheduled for July. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
For decades, Maine has had a bottle redemption system for soda, beer, and liquor bottles to encourage recycling and to prevent littering. Now, the Maine House has voted to expand the deposit law to include small liquor bottles, or NIPS. Mal Leary has more.
Representative Richard Campbell, a Republican from Orrington, lives near a local store and says he's surprised by the number of empty bottles and cans he finds scattered across his yard.
It's not so much litter, but it's the distance from picking it up at the store, depositing in oneself, and then throwing it out the window.
Campbell said he's been able to put away $450 in a savings account for his young grandson from the deposits on beer and soda containers he collects near the house. He's among those state lawmakers who support expanding the bottle deposit law to include NIPS, little bottles that hold less than 50 milliliters and have been growing in popularity. But because there's no deposit on them, they've been causing an emerging litter problem. Representative Jonathan Kinney, a Republican from Lymington, said he would rather use the more than $1 million cost to implement the legislation on other litter control strategies.
We have an overall problem with trash pollution. I believe a broader positive environmental effects could result from looking at other approaches to litter prevention.
Kinney says that creative advertising campaigns might be more effective in convincing people not to litter. Representative Christopher Babbage, a Democrat from Kennebunk, says the state also has a drinking problem, and he wishes the measure would discourage alcohol consumption, but acknowledges that it probably will not.
The bill before us, the motion before us, is not going to discourage purchase, much to my dismay, but it is environmentally sound, and it's a baby step in the right direction.
If given final approval, the Nips bottles would join the long list of glass, metal, and plastic beverage containers that have been added to the bottle deposit law since it was first passed in 1978. Governor Paul LePage has not expressed an opinion on the legislation, but the support in the House shows that the measure may have the votes to withstand a veto. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
A Maine businessman wants $6 million in government funding to protect a plantation of sap-producing maple trees in rural Somerset County near the Canadian border. But some question whether the property should qualify for a conservation easement. Because it's heavily used by Canadian maple syrup producers, there's no real development threat, and it's very remote. In the first of two reports, Steve Missler visits the forest known as Big Six, a day-long journey that required four border crossings.
Paul Fortin prefers to keep his land and timber deals private. But he's agreed to escort a reporter and a photographer to what's known as Big Six, a township at the northwest edge of Somerset County. Fortin wants to showcase a prized 4,500-acre plantation of sap-producing maple forest, also known as sugarbush. But getting there requires a passport.
Where are you going?
We're going up to St. Orleans and going back into the United States to a sugarbush.
Okay, what purpose?
They're doing an interview on the sugaring business.
There's a network of logging roads into Big Six from Maine, but they're rough and often impassable during mud season. So Fortin clears the Jackman-Armstrong border crossing and begins a 45-minute drive across southern Quebec to a second crossing at St. Orleans. Along the way, he explains over the din of heavy rain why he's seeking a combined $6 million in federal and state funding for a conservation easement.
We were planning on cutting 4,500 acres of very, very heavily wooded with valuable hardwoods. They were the sugar bushes.
The sugar bush in Big Six is said to account for up to 25% of Maine's maple syrup production. And when Fortin bought the property 4 years ago, he planned to cut it for hardwood lumber. He says he was persuaded not to by a legislative task force and by the LePage administration.
So we were under a fair amount of pressure to come up with a different plan. And that's where we are today.
And that plan is to have the federal government pay Fortin $3.5 million to leave the sugar bush intact. Funding will come from the Forest Legacy Program, which is intended to protect environmentally significant forest lands that are threatened with development. He also needs another $2 million from the Land for Maine's Future program to complete the deal. An old logging road takes us to one of the property's eight sugar camps, where producers pay Fortin to tap the maple trees and make maple syrup. We stop to tour an industrial-sized warehouse at the center of a cleared lot. Fortin knocks on the door and enters.
Hello? Wait.
A stout man shouts across the warehouse in French. Christian Poirier says he lives in Saint-Côme, Quebec, and that he and his business partner leased more than 32,000 taps from Fortin.
You see the tent?
Sure.
Poirier's English is limited, but he proudly leads a tour of the facility, showing off the equipment and the new storage space holding 55-gallon drums of syrup.
There it is.
It's happening. Here.
Yep.
At another sugar camp, we meet 67-year-old Guillaume Rodrigue, who has been sugaring at Big Six for nearly 30 years. Over that time, he's grown his number of taps from 14,000 to over 70,000. Guillaume fears that if Fortin doesn't get his easement, the maple trees will have to be cut, and he and his son Bernard will lose their livelihood.
That's my life. That's more life, on and on. Yeah. If we don't have it up here, we can't stay here. We need to bring all this stuff, and we lose everything.
This is our life, he says. We'll lose everything. But some question whether Big Six qualifies for a conservation easement. Mike Farrell, who studied the maple syrup industry for Cornell University, wonders if the threat to the Big Six sugar bush is overstated. There's more money in keeping them than cutting them down for timber, he says.
There's already a lot of tadpoles in that wood, and so the commercial value of those trees has been reduced, and it makes the most sense to continue tapping those stands.
Some privately question whether it's appropriate to pay for and to maintain a 23,000 acres of far-flung forest land that is not easily accessible to the public. And others say they see no real development threats to Big Six. But J.T. Horn of the Trust for Public Land says there is a threat from the Canadian side. Horn joined us on the ride to Big Six because the National Conservation Group is helping Fortin with the easement application.
Where the property is located, it is pretty remote from population centers in Maine, but it's only about 90 minutes from Quebec City, and there's a huge market for camps and hunting and fishing properties and for, you know, subdivisions for cabins that are coming from the Canadian side.
In fact, Horn says the first application for Forest Legacy funds was actually turned down because the development threat to Big Six didn't score high enough. TPL reframed the threat, focusing on development pressure from Canada, and the easement was approved. Fortin has also been fending off charges that Big Six is a political transaction, a reward for his campaign contributions to Governor Paul LePage, who has otherwise been a vocal critic of land conservation programs. Fortin was asked if it would have been easier to just cut the sugar bush.
It would have been a lot easier, and I wouldn't have to deal with all of the controversy. No one in my business likes to be in the newspaper, especially in a negative fashion when you did not create it.
But some question whether Mainers should subsidize an easement that will allow Canadian entrepreneurs to continue to produce and sell syrup without a Maine label on it. In fact, very little of Big Six syrup is even sold in Maine. Rium Rodrigue opens a massive shipping container full of 55-gallon drums.
Here it is. That's a lot of syrup.
Yeah.
And it's all heading to Vermont, where it will be sold as a product of the U.S., and with likely no mention of where it came from. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, May 9th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.